This is Faith Matters on 89.1, Lubbock's Voice of the Arts. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life, the trials, the tribulations, and the triumphs. Discussions about how faith matters to you and our community. Only on 89.1, Lubbock's Voice of the Arts. Support for Faith Matters is brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine. Now, here are your hosts, Ryan Price and David Cruz.
Welcome to Faith Matters. I'm Ryan Price along with David Cruz, and we are sitting here today with a returning guest, Ted Dotz, who is a former Methodist minister and now serves as chaplain for Carillon Life Care Community, and someone who has been a good friend to both David and I for a long time. We are pleased to welcome you back to the studio, Ted.
Welcome, Ted.
Thank you, David.
Ted, you are someone who has worked within the realm of chaplaincy for some time and specifically have some experience within the penal system as a chaplain yourself when you were in seminary. We thought today we would simply begin a discussion with something that author Michelle Alexander has called the New Jim Crow, which is essentially her label for what she sees as the disproportionate number of blacks and Latinos being incarcerated here in the United States. I know that this is something that you're passionate about, or very knowledgeable about also. Just tell us a little bit about why we ought to be concerned. What is going on in your understanding?
Well, I'm concerned as a citizen of the country. Just historically, if you remember, after the Civil War, Reconstruction took place. And under Reconstruction, a lot of black people left slavery and were able to be elected to office in the South. But in 1877, the federal troops were withdrawn, and so the Jim Crow laws came into effect. Those laws were all designed to keep black people in a new form of slavery, so that states passed laws that kept them from voting or by literacy tests or other kinds of things. Now, with the civil rights movement and the election of Obama, it seemed to appear that blacks have gained equality and that the society is integrated. But my argument would be that the prison system shows the opposite, that what we've devised and developed through the war on drugs is a way to imprison, especially young black men, although Hispanics and some women are also in prison. But the young black men, I think, constitute close to 1 million of the prisoners today out of the 2 million that the United States has. So it's a huge issue because a country that is blinded to inequality and unfairness is a country that's in serious trouble. And so we're stirring up an awful pottage.
Do you agree with that label, New Jim Crow?
Yes, certainly. And the prison system is the best illustration of it. New Jim Crow laws following on the war on drugs allowed us to imprison people for possession of marijuana. And when we just target certain groups to do that, blacks, Hispanics are targeted. Did the same kind of sweeps on drug use in this country and, say, targeted white community. Like I often think, if the drug people targeted the Greek Circle here at Tech as much as they would target certain areas in town, we would start having a whole lot of white people in jail rather than blacks.
Ted, knowing that we were going to discuss this subject today, I wanted to ask your take and your thoughts on a program that was initiated a couple of years ago in the prison system of the state of Texas. It's actually modeled on a program in Louisiana at Angola State Prison in Louisiana, where they are working with a seminary here in Texas, and I'm talking about the Texas prison system, to train and to educate inmates. And I'm talking about inmates who are serving time for hard crimes, some of them lifelong sentences, to study to be chaplains. And so the program consists of 4 years. It's 125 credit hours. And the graduates of the program, the inmates, when they finish and complete everything, receive bachelor's of science degrees in biblical studies. And then they're sent out to a variety of prisons in the state. Now, they started out with 40 inmates. They're up to 114 inmates now. And soon they're going to be graduating some of the people that have gone through the all of the requirements. It's kind of controversial, and the state had to approve it. The governor had to sign off on it. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, number one, I feel good about it. My thought is that in a prison system that's bent more towards punishment than anything that can happen that doesn't have the aura of punishment about it is good. You take prisoners like this, many of them uneducated, and give them a seminary education, I think you have a chance of making a vast improvement in them and then with whom they're able to deal. I do think it'll be a hard thing. I spent years visiting every Saturday when I was a pastor at the county jail, and immediately you're identified either on the side of law enforcement or on the side of the prisoner. If you visit a prisoner, you're tended to make a bit of enmity, maybe among law enforcement. That people don't often like to admit that, but it's, for me, it was a clear case. So I think it'll have a tough time, but I'd certainly be supportive of it.
One of the statistics that was quoted in some of the research that I did on this in Louisiana, once they instituted this seminary program for inmate chaplains, that at Angola State Prison, the rate of aggression and violent crime inside of the unit, the prison unit, dropped 70%.
Wonderful. I didn't know that figure, but that's excellent.
Ted, you talk about the enmity between, say, prison guards and inmates, and then it reminds me of a conversation that I had with someone yesterday who was formerly worked for the district attorney's office. I won't say which office or what year. But his job was a matter of investigation and prosecution. He was telling me about the adversarial role sometimes he played within the office itself of trying to hold police officers to the highest standard possible of law and justice with respect to pursuing criminals and what a tension that is. And he said something very profound to me. He said, I always kept in my mind the fact that Jesus himself was falsely accused, falsely charged, accused, tried, and convicted, and put to death. And he said, that really shaped my life work to recognize that my Lord and Savior would have been amongst this crowd of people. And he said it helped him to keep things in perspective. Your comments on that?
Well, that's, I hope, a Christian view. We would find it a standard. The one thing you left out in your list, if you remember, Jesus was struck in the face. And so that kind of thing, if a prosecutor has that in mind, that might be Jesus there, would hesitate maybe to work some violence. So I'm glad to hear the program.
When we return, Ryan, I know we're about to go on break. I want to ask Ted about Paul's letter to Philemon and how that was written from a prison, and ask your thoughts on that.
You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.
You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts with your hosts Ryan Price and David Cruz, brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm Ryan Price along with David Cruz, and we are sitting here today with our guest Ted Dotts, who is chaplain at Carillon Life Care Community, and is also someone who has served as a Methodist minister for several decades and has been someone who has extensive experience within the prison system, both as a pastor and also as a chaplain. Very glad to have you here, Ted. And before the break, David alluded to a question that he has about a particular piece of scripture that speaks to the prison system.
Ted, you will recall that one of the most beautiful letters in all of the New Testament, it's actually a very short letter, but it's very compelling, is a letter written by Paul the Apostle to an early Christian convert by the name of Philemon, asking him to take back a runaway slave by the name of Onesimus, who had left his household and meets Paul in prison. And now Paul has converted him to Christianity, and he writes this letter in his own hand, and he sends it to Philemon, basically appealing to his goodwill and his charity, and saying, please accept Onesimus as your brother. Treat him as you would my own heart, and forgive him if he's stolen from you. In fact, Paul goes on to say, I will repay you. So that's a little brief synopsis of the letter. Mm-hmm. How does it tie into this conversation? Does it have, or what does it have to teach us about the way that we sometimes are so punitive and less willing to rehabilitate those in the prison system? We're willing to punish, but we don't talk much about rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like your question, but suppose we're the Philemon and we're being approached by two prisoners. Paul himself was a jailbird. So we got two prisoners asking us for mercy. Letter doesn't tell us how Philemon responded, but that's maybe left up to us then. How would we respond?
May I interrupt you? Very scary, I think.
Yeah.
For the average listener, people listening in and say, well, geez, that is a tremendous risk to take, to be willing to give somebody another chance in my place of business, in my home, in my community, even in my church.
Sure. Add to that, if we make it contemporary, say a young black man comes out of prison. He can't vote. He can't get public housing. He can't get on welfare. He can't get food stamps. In some states, he can't have a driver's license. And many of our major businesses, like I know for a fact a major fast food group here in town, because I've approached them on behalf of prisoners, won't hire anyone that comes out of prison. So take a young man dropped back in this society with no one standing up for him. St. Paul, in that letter, gives us a good approach to how to stand up for someone that has no standing. And indeed, if we don't stand up for them and find some way to do it, we only generate more crime.
Ted, a word, a term comes to mind as y'all are talking here, as we're talking here. Something I've heard several times used in the past to describe another form of punishment other than the retributive kind that seeks to mete out justice, but another kind that seeks to rehabilitate as well, restorative justice is what I've heard it called. When that word is used, what are we talking about there when we talk about restorative justice?
Well, basis of the word, restore. I mean, I don't know how everyone defines sin, but I define sin as being alienated from what's good about me. And so when I get alienated from my good, I'll do awful things. So restorative justice has to do with restoring us to the goodness that God has created. Now notice that presupposes that it's there. And that's an assumption maybe that many people don't begin with. Maybe we begin with the assumption of shame. Shame on them, they're a terrible, awful person. St. Paul doesn't do that in the letter to Philemon. He says, this is my friend, he's converted, I'm standing up for him. Now what if we approached any felon like that? Now I don't think we're smart enough to be able to find the good. I mean, we send people to therapists or clergy trying to get through this alienation from the good that sin does. So we probably have to have prisons in a way for the people we fail with. But I don't think we have to fail with all of them, and I don't think we even ought to begin to admit that we will fail and keep 7 million people tied up to the prison system. Mm. I think felons that we can't really help have to be kept away from society, but that's not everyone. And many people have marvelous moments when they come back in touch with their goodness and then become contributing members.
When you would go and visit the jail here in town, or before that, the penitentiary where you were on staff as a chaplain, what would the conversations be like with the inmates which you were having? Can you give us some insight into that?
Well, if you go up, say, on the unit, and often prisoners are in different states of mind like anyone else. But sometimes I'd visit where there'd be a number of prisoners in a cell. A county jail will especially put people in units where several prisoners are in one cell. And the prisoners, when they'd come to the bars in the old county jail, they'd ask me, well, what can you give us? Well, if you go visit in the county jail, you have to agree you will not carry messages in and out. You won't carry any items in and out. You won't call a lawyer. You won't call a family. There's nothing you can do. And so my answer would be, well, the thing I can do is to listen to you. Well, many prisoners, who wants to be listened to? But when those who wanted to talk, and there were always a large number, used to take me 3 or 4 hours every Saturday morning to go around and hear just a few stories. Listening is the primal act of love. And to be able to listen carefully to someone loves them. And once we are loved, we begin to make startling changes. Often they're very subtle and not obvious, but at least that's a kind of faith I go on. So the most I could do was listen. The best they could do was to tell their stories as thoroughly as they could.
You just reminded me, Ted, of a lovely book, and some people wouldn't call it lovely, very provocative, some would say, written some years ago by a little Cajun nun by the name of Helen Prejean, mm-hmm. who made it her life's work and ministry to visit death row inmates in Louisiana, and then a movie was made called Dead Man Walking based on her book. And she says in that book how as abominable as some of the crimes and atrocities that these men on death row committed, that it was always a challenge for her to see the human face of God in them.
Well, isn't that the challenge for us all? I mean, we come at things with our presuppositions. That person's black or brown or evil. But who was it Jesus went to? He was condemned all the time for the people he went to who were the cast-offs of society. Where else are we? If God has created us good and we've gotten alienated, what else can we do but go with the supposition that somewhere, even if we can't see it, the good is there?
Ted, I appreciate this conversation so much. When we come back, I want to go back into when we're talking about justice. And one of the things that Helen Prejean says is that her work in charity and just with human beings led her essentially, ultimately, to a point of advocating for justice. When we come back, we'll still be with Ted Dodds. You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.
This is Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts. Support for Faith Matters is brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine. Now, here are your hosts, Ryan Price and David Cruz.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm Ryan Price, along with David Cruz, and we have here today with us Ted Dodds, who is chaplain at Caroline Life Care Community and also a former Methodist minister and someone who has worked as a chaplain both in the prison system and then outside for a number of years. And we've been having a conversation, Ted, about your work in prisons and with the prison population, also the jail population here in Lubbock County. And it's brought us back, as we were speaking in the last segment, about Helen Prejean. And I heard her give a talk once where she talked about beginning with a certain human need, a need to minister to the needs of people, individual people, recognizing that they had wounds or cares that needed to be addressed. But she said ultimately that led her to a place of recognizing that her work had to be not only about charity, but also about justice, about a sense of the ways in which certain people are marginalized throughout the community. And that kind of brings us back to what you were saying at the very beginning of our conversation about the prison system. But I was thinking about St. Joseph's here, the Catholic hospital system that Covenant Works is under, and they have a certain number of values, and one of those values is justice. And I just wanted to read, I think this, I walk by this all the time in the hospital when I'm at Covenant, and I think that this says succinctly what I think is important about understanding how we ought to think about justice, and this is what it says. We advocate for systems and structures that are attuned to the needs of the vulnerable and disadvantaged, and that promote a sense of community among all persons. And when I see that, I just think, you know, it's being mindful of those who are on the margins of our society, whether it's those who've been in prison or otherwise. Can you just comment on that?
Well, I'd first think that the very basic foundation of that is that we are loved. If that is the core basic foundation, we are loved, then there flows out of that a need to set things right. It's like when we are loved, once that pervades our heart, then we want to go out and love. And justice is a way, a form that we do it. One of the first words in what you read, remember, was advocate. So once we know we're deeply loved, we will go advocate for it. I think it's when we don't start there, when we start with some kind of moral code that we've gotten, that we should do so-and-so, that things burn out or they go astray. That's why the Pope's words are so important, because what I think he's saying to the church and to the world, let's remember now, first we're loved, and then we get into things like morals, and let's be sure we remember that we inculcate that we are loved into those morals. So justice is something that follows from being loved. Then we're able to love.
Ted, you brought up the Pope, and his comments of a few days ago made it onto the front page of the Wall Street Journal, even, and certainly despite every other major newspaper in the country. He kind of admonished the church, saying what the church needs most today is the ability to heal wounds and warm hearts, not so much to emphasize a morality that includes very stringent stances on abortion, gay marriage, the use of contraceptive methods. And he said, and I'm quoting directly, "We don't have to discuss these issues all the time. We need a balance between these moral issues that we feel strongly about, but that love and tenderness and mercy that warms the human heart." It's gotten a lot of attention. How do you read his remarks?
Well, I read his remarks with great pleasure and gladness. For one, he understands quite well what religion is. Religion is a good thing, but it's also very dangerous. It's not God. And so that it has to constantly receive the kind of judgment, and he's promoting it. He's doing it. He's doing it gently and kindly. But now, that's pretty serious when you tell a church, look, all your great morals and your intensity there are off the mark a bit. Let's get back to mercy. I mean, he's critiqued religion, which it needs a constant critique. We're not saved by religion. We're saved by God.
Now, here's how some take the statement, though, because he did receive some criticism. It wasn't all favorable. And it's the criticism that goes something like this. In a world that's so permissive, where there's so much moral ambivalence or a lack of morality, and we see so much upheaval that this lack of clarity on moral issues has caused, we see pain that it causes. Are we then just making people more permissive by giving them the impression that we ought not to emphasize morality but now de-emphasize it? That's a criticism, huh?
Well, but it's a criticism has been made. You remember St. Paul, when he talks about the grace of God, people say, oh, we're just turning this loose to wild permissiveness. And Paul says, you're not getting this at all. Once you understand how deeply you're loved, you'll go out and do your very best to love. So if you're telling me that I'm getting permissive, you haven't understood how deeply loved you are. Once you're deeply loved, you'll flow with this other, and you can trust it. So I think he's catching heavy criticism, but it comes from a kind of legalistic bent. Actually, it comes from an idolatry that says, if we'll just do the right things, we'll save ourselves. We are saved by God. God's name is love.
I would like to hear Ryan's take on this as well. Ryan, thoughts?
As far as the Pope goes, I certainly welcome as a breath of fresh air a changing of the tenor and tone of the conversation. I really don't know that the Pope is making any sort of formal doctrinal or dogmatic statements with respect to any of those particular moral issues as understood by the Catholic Church. But there does seem to be a certain graciousness to what he's saying, and I sure appreciate that. I think it's healthy not only for the Catholic Church, but actually I think that Protestants could take a page off of this and learn a bit about how to talk about welcoming everyone to the table.
Ryan, those are certainly very insightful comments that you and Ted have offered. And I think it's a reminder that what the Pope is saying more recently to Catholics, but possibly because he's had such an appeal even to a wider audience, is something that we're going to be wrestling with. Maybe this de-emphasis on moral issues, but a greater emphasis on what you said, inclusivity. And in fact, I think you're right on. You said what he's saying even has something that Protestants can take something from. So it'll be good to unwrap this and to continue to unfold what he's saying and what he's teaching. And I thank you and Ted both for the insights you've had to offer.
We're out of time. Ted, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you back. And David, wonderful to be with you again. You can catch this program and all other programs on our website if you go to kttz.org and click on the Faith Matters tab. You've been listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.